This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
This is America Changed Forever from the CBS Audio Network.
I'm Jeff Begays, filling in for Gil Gross. On this edition of America Changed Forever from CBS News Radio, President Biden overseas on his first foreign trip. CBS News is reporting that his focus will be on projecting America's commitment to rallying the world. But will he be able to mend fences with allies who former President Trump often mocked? And how will President Biden handle Russian President Vladimir Putin, given the spate of Russia-linked ransomware attacks here in the U.S.? These are high-stakes meetings for Mr. Biden, who has to show that his experience in Washington and foreign policy will mean diplomacy wins. First, Max Bergman, a senior fellow at American Progress. He served in the State Department for about 6 years.
The meeting with Putin is going to be a really tough meeting. The Biden administration is trying to thread a needle. They don't want to have a confrontation with Russia become all-consuming. They want to focus on China, and they view Russia as a really annoying distraction.
Also, John Cypher spent 28 years in the CIA, where he served multiple tours as chief of station and deputy chief of station in high-threat environments, including Moscow.
There's very little, frankly, we need from Russia. Certainly, there's some issues that we can talk about. It's just moving towards more standard diplomacy rather than, you know, pushing for headlines. And so, you know, if not much comes out of this, I think that's a win, frankly.
And finally, Paul Colby, who is the director of the Intelligence Project at the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School.
We saw this week that a bipartisan approach to a perceived external challenge can take place even in this political environment. And, you know, we're always in a political environment of one sort or another. You know, politics didn't start in the last few years.
Let's begin with Max Bergman and the G7. Max, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so we're talking about the upcoming summit. Let's start at the beginning, really. What are these summits, what are they like?
So the G7 is sort of the seven richest industrial countries. The G20 was sort of expanded because, you know, there was a lot more than seven that were emerging, particularly in like the 90s and 2000s. But the G7 became the G8 for a while when Russia was added. And, you know, that Russia was sort of famously kicked out of the G8 by Obama. And what this summit in particular is really about is kind of America's strongest and closest allies and sort of the richest countries in the world getting together to sort of deal with global problems. And there's always a lot of question of, is the G7 relevant? Should we continue with it? But there's so much for the world to talk about right now. So one of the things they're going to talk about is, how do we put taxes on corporations so they actually have to pay some tax and can't sort of shelter? There's obviously COVID to talk about. And then there's also just issues like, you know, what to deal with, how to deal with China, how to deal with Russia, how to deal with all the cyber attacks that are going on. And these summits provide an opportunity to both, you know, for leaders to read the talking points that have been prepared and for all the kind of bureaucrats in the background to kind of hammer out deals, but also to just get to know each other, right? Seven people, seven leaders, not a lot of them. There's a few others that get to be invited. They have dinner, they get to talk, they get to kind of, you know, get to know each other a bit better. And the idea is that that helps when a crisis comes up, you know, in a few months from now, and Biden needs to get on the phone with a leader who maybe he's never met before, who's new, that he met at the G7 and then can talk through, and they already have a personal relationship established. So it's both about getting business done. It's also about establishing a real rapport between the biggest leaders in the world.
So it's much more than just a Zoom call. It's actually meeting people face to face and sitting in these rooms. But, you know, as a journalist, as we see the images coming back from these summits, these big meetings with world leaders, you know, you wonder, has all the legwork been done prior to these meetings? Are they really hammering out deals in these meetings?
So a lot of the legwork has been done beforehand. There's actually a term that you know, each government sort of anoints someone called a Sherpa to kind of coordinate and to sort of negotiate with the other G7 countries ahead of time. And the idea is that, well, if you just show up and you know, this is sort of what unfortunately happened a lot during the Trump administration. He just sort of showed up at meetings and there wasn't a lot accomplished because in order to hammer out deals that are complex that can be announced, the work has to be done ahead of time. And meetings also, big summits like this serve as forcing functions for the bureaucracy, right? The boss is going and he needs a deliverable or she needs a deliverable. They want to get something done so they can have a big announcement. And that puts pressure on everyone to ahead of time to work together well, to make deals, to sort of move from their kind of current positions. And it creates sort of a sense of urgency. But that being said, there's also a lot to discuss. So they create some things that they're able to get agreement on. And then there's other issues that they're just sort of going to talk about, right? Maybe they'll talk about China and the problem of China or Russia and what the Russians are doing. Or they weren't able to really, you know, get much progress on something. And so, okay, they're just going to sort of discuss where their differences are. And then maybe with all the leaders around the table, they sort of can help provide new direction. You suddenly get Biden to focus for, you know, a couple hours or for a whole day on a certain topic that leads to discussions and deal making. So, you know, I would say it's a bit of both, right? So most of the legwork has been done, but there's real opportunities for breakthroughs and for announcements as well.
I wonder for President Biden, is this going to be, is the takeaway ultimately going to be for him, you know what, I expressed to the rest of the world that we are back?
Yeah, that is, I think, their sort of top line, you know, campaign style slogan in which they're going through not just the G7, but when they meet with NATO, when they have the summit with the EU, that America's back. Now, I think for a lot of Europeans, there's a big question of like, well, what does that actually mean? You know, back for A, how long are you back for? And so there's a lot of concern that America sort of may be becoming more unstable. And then the second issue for many of them, and many Europeans, is that, well, during Obama, they felt somewhat neglected. So returning to kind of the Obama period, you know, they kind of want more and are looking for more from the United States. And so I think that's a good message. I think, you know, it's being well received by European leaders. But I think that this is the kind of last week that he can sort of make that message that America's back. It'll now be about what is America doing? And I think that we're going to start to see a lot of announcements that are clearly indicate that a new approach and new energy in trying to really rebuild transatlantic ties, particularly between the U.S. and NATO and the U.S. and EU.
What do you think is going to be more heavy lifting for President Biden? Is it going to be the G7? Or is it going to be this meeting with Vladimir Putin?
So I think the meeting with Putin is going to be a really tough meeting. I think the Biden administration is trying to thread a needle where what they don't want to have a confrontation with Russia become all consuming, become the thing that is, you know, dominating Biden's attention both domestically and from a foreign policy perspective. They want to focus on China. They want to focus on sort of other big issues. And they view Russia as a really annoying distraction. And one that if you sort of get into both a diplomatic and espionage sort of cyber fights with them, then it's going to become all consuming because it has to be because they're a nuclear armed power. Vladimir Putin knows that. And what he wants is the fight. And he wants to get into squabbles with the United States. He wants to be seen as going toe-to-toe with the United States. That's why we saw Russia amass forces on Ukraine's border, why they, you know, create a safe haven for cyber hackers that then attack our pipelines, that attack our, you know, meat industry. And so I think this is a summit where Biden wants to sort of lay out clear red lines and boundaries for the Russians and sort of say, if you do this or keep doing this, then there's going to be real consequences. But on the other hand, doesn't want to become all consumed by a confrontation with Vladimir Putin. And I think this is going to be a tough needle to thread. I think what we're going to see is a much more confrontational press conference than we saw when Trump met with Putin in Helsinki and was sort of clearly deferential. I think we're going to see Biden stand up to Putin, but at the same time not want to sort of get into kind of a ridiculous kind of chest thumping exercise. So we'll see. I think, you know, all eyes will be in Switzerland where, you know, their meeting will be the end of a long week of summits. And, you know, I think it's going to be an intense meeting.
Max Bergman, thank you.
Thank you so much.
When we come back, John Cipher, looking ahead at Biden versus Putin. Stay with us. This is America Changed Forever from CBS News Radio. Welcome back to America Changed Forever from CBS News Radio. Thanks for staying with us. John Cipher was in the CIA, and he was stationed in a lot of high-threat environments, including Moscow, where he ran the agency's Russia operations. This coming Wednesday, Putin and Biden will meet, and there is a lot to hash out. Russia's interference in the 2016 and 2020 election, and the latest cyber attacks on U.S. critical infrastructure by cyber gangs based in Russia. John Cipher, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
I want to start at the beginning of your career in the CIA, because that'll help inform our listeners of how you've gained your experience, especially as we talk about Vladimir Putin and his past and the KGB as we head into this meeting with President Biden. So tell us, you were in the CIA for how many years?
I was in the CIA for 28 years.
28 years, and you were focused on Russia for some of that time.
I was, and you know, in the clandestine service, we moved from post to post every 2 to 4 years. But if I had sort of a specialty, it was counterintelligence and Russia issues.
Interesting. And so I've been following your career. I've been following your thoughts as you put them in print. And over the years, especially after the Russian intrusions during the 2016 election, you've talked a lot about Vladimir Putin and his mindset. And you sort of examined that in his meetings with Donald Trump. So tell us what you thought about those meetings when they happened. I hate, you know, in some ways to look back, but it helps to look back to look to the future. So what did you think about former President Trump's interactions with Vladimir Putin at the time?
Well, I was a little bit concerned because, you know, the differences in where they came from. Vladimir Putin calls himself a proud Czechist, and the Cheka was the Russian intelligence service, or it was the early Soviet intelligence service after the Bolshevik Revolution. And he had a whole career in the KGB, spying against the West and has that sort of mindset. Whereas Donald Trump, you know, had little experience in foreign policy and was very focused, you know, on business and sort of enriching himself. And so he was the kind of person I thought that Vladimir Putin could potentially, you know, manipulate to Russia's benefit and to the detriment of the United States. And I think we saw that over the last few years. I mean, Trump tried to befriend Putin and normalize relations with Russia, and that strategy ended up not achieving much for us, if anything.
Yeah, and if you look back at that meeting in Helsinki, which was a dropper for many of us who follow the news and who are obviously aware of what happened in 2016 with the election, where, you know, during this meeting in Helsinki, President Trump essentially discounted the assessment of U.S. intelligence officials in favor of what Vladimir Putin was thinking.
Yeah, I think that's true. And a lot of that had to do with, you know, President Trump's style. You know, he was very much not interested in expertise or what the U.S. intelligence community had to say or our foreign policy experts and diplomats. You know, he wanted to do things sort of by his own instinct. And I think that is a thing that Vladimir Putin saw and thought that he could take advantage of for his purpose.
And do you think, as we head into this meeting between Putin and Biden, do you think that President Biden will rely on his instincts or his experience in politics?
Well, that's interesting. So, I mean, I think anyone who gets to that level, has quite an ego and believes that their instincts are something they should follow. And that's not unusual for politicians. However, we also know that President Biden has years and years of experience in foreign policy issues. So, his meeting with Vladimir Putin is by no means the first time they've met or the first time they've engaged each other. And also, President Biden has been working with the State Department and our diplomats and our intelligence services for quite a long time. And so I think there'll be a mix of things. I mean, I think his willingness to meet personally with Putin suggests that he values his own opinion. He values his ability to get with Putin and maybe, make clear what he thinks U.S. policy should be and set guideposts. But I think he will also do it, within the full, briefing and knowledge and support of our institutions. And so I think there's a large difference between how President Trump saw his first meeting with Putin and how President Biden does.
And how is there not bad blood between Putin and Biden, given some of the things that President Biden has said about Vladimir Putin, calling him a killer? So do they get into these meeting rooms, and is there tension there because of past statements and past actions?
I think there is bad blood, and I think there is tension. I think we saw in the 2016 election, you could make an argument that the Russian interference and attack on our election was in many ways in an effort to damage Hillary Clinton, because he believed that Hillary Clinton had a bad relationship with him and was interfering in Russian elections, is what he believed. Of course, not true. And so, yes, they do have a long history of meeting together, but it has not always been friendly. But in a sense, that's okay. President Biden is representing U.S. interests here, not, personal interests. And I think he'll be able to make a distinction between the two.
What do you think will be the win that President Biden can walk away from these meetings with? Is it on cyber? Given the amount of ransomware attacks we've seen, where there are links to criminal cyber gangs in Russia, in Eastern Europe, do you think that President Biden can score some points there if he tells Putin, hey, cut it out? I think that's the phrase Obama used in 2016 or during that time. But what does Biden stand to gain here?
Well, interestingly, I don't think there is a lot to gain. I don't think there are wins. My assessment is that Biden really wants to be able to focus elsewhere and not spend a lot of time dealing with Russia and Russian attacks. I think he wants to be able to focus on, our large relationship over the next decades with China. And I think he wants to deal with the COVID crisis and re-strengthening our relationships with our allies. And so in this sense, I think boring is good. I think what he's looking to do is move towards a more normalized style of diplomacy engagement. These relationships aren't meant to be, theater and PR events. We shouldn't have necessarily high expectations, for what's going on here. There's very little, frankly, we need from Russia. Certainly there's some issues that we can talk about. Biden can make it very clear that, what he expects from Putin and what issues that, the United States will push back against. But and it sets some expectations and guardrails. But I think in this sense, it's just moving towards more standard diplomacy rather than, pushing for headlines. And so I don't think we should, if not much comes out of this, I think that's a win, frankly.
What do you think, given your intelligence background, what do you think about Vladimir Putin and how he has led Russia with these seemingly increased crackdowns on opposition leaders and groups?
Putin has been in power for over 20 years now. So I think we have a clear sense of who he is and what is important to him. And so in these discussions, I think the onus should be on Putin if one of the goals is to, quote unquote, improve relations. But recall, Putin has shown really no interest over the past decades in improving relations. There's really nothing much that he could say that could undercut the last decade of constant attacks on the West. And in the same sense, negotiating with him in some ways doesn't make a lot of sense. as I read somewhere recently, someone said, a firefighter and arsonist cannot meet halfway. You know, better relations are only possible in some sense if we sacrifice our values and our interests and maybe even our allies. And so in this sense, I think, you know, they have to have a discussion, but I think President Biden is going in with sort of clear knowledge of what Putin is. You know, Putin chose to confront the West as his primary form of government. He wasn't forced to. You know, he has a foreign policy of sabotage and subversion, and that also helps him domestically. You know, he needs an enemy, a straw man at home, so he can blame his weak performance and weak economic performance to his people. So he chose this covert global face-off instead of, you know, a win-win world. You know, to him, win-win means I beat you twice. So in this sense, the biggest danger for us and for President Biden is, you know, that if we're seen to be negotiating, if we're seen to give any concessions to the Russians here, it will be seen as weakness by Putin. And, you know, he will see the West and us as weak, unfocused, and potentially corruptible. So I think, you know, again, we shouldn't expect a lot out of this. This is for these two men to make it clear where they stand. So those few things that we can work together, we can do so, and hopefully at a lower level than at president-to-president level. But I don't think we should expect a lot.
When we come back, more of my discussion with John Cypher. This is America Change Forever from CBS News Radio.
It's harder to focus than ever these days. Thankfully, C4 has reinvented the energy drink game with C4 Smart Energy, the only energy drink clinically proven to provide enhanced mental focus, containing 200 milligrams of natural caffeine, a blend of vitamins and zero sugar. It was formulated to support your well-being and help you feel your best, all while enhancing mental focus. From your brain to your body, C4 Smart Energy does it all, and tastes amazing. Look for Smart Energy in the beverage aisle at your local Kroger, Albertsons, and Safeway grocery stores. C4 Smart Energy. Stay focused.
Welcome back to America Change Forever as we continue our conversation with John Cypher.
I don't know if a lot of our listeners are aware of this, but you know, having written a book on the 2016 election interference and having researched Putin and his worldview, and I just want to get your thoughts on this. He believes that a weaker United States is obviously a stronger Russia. The more that he can denigrate democracy, the better he looks. I think that's basically, you know, that's the message that you were discussing in the last couple of minutes. And I don't think that a lot of people in this country realize that when we sort of dismiss his intelligence community's intrusions on our elections, we do it as Americans at our own peril, because what he wants to see is a weaker United States of America.
I think that's right. I think part of the problem with our politics is we look at each other through a domestic and partisan lens rather than looking at it the way Vladimir Putin does. And so I think there was this automatic assumption that his attack on the election was meant to benefit Donald Trump. And I think it was in 2016. If it was meant to benefit Donald Trump, it was because Putin saw Donald Trump as the chaos candidate who could actually. And so Putin's goal is to weaken the West, to weaken the United States, to look for our vulnerabilities and take advantage of them, and to weaken our relationship with our allies. It wasn't so much that he was, you know, interested in one candidate over another. You know, he is invested in this adversarial relationship with the West that helps keep him in power. You know, he's had this narrative of grievance for almost 20 years now. And again, like I said, domestically, it's handy to have a straw man to blame and deflect attention from his internal problems.
Do you, in the short term, let's say 5 years, do you see a Russia without Vladimir Putin leading it?
I don't see that in the near term. I think we should, you know, go into these kind of meetings understanding, you know, Russia at the end of the day, you know, it's not a large economic power, but it does have, you know, a lot of nuclear weapons and military power. It can create problems, you know, with our allies and around the world. And so we do have to engage with them. And frankly, we do, you know, we have an embassy there. We have diplomatic contacts. Our intelligence services are in charge. But there has to be a way, to push back against Putin. We can't sacrifice our values to do so, but we have to be very clear about what we need to do. Putin has made himself into a dictator. He's changed their constitution so that he can stay in power, essentially until he dies. But the danger with that, obviously, is there's no sort of valve to put off pressure. And so, when you're a dictator, you have to worry day by day about how you stay in power. You cannot show any weakness. You cannot, if there's protests or in your country or there's threats in the countries around you, you see that as a serious threat and needs to be, crushed. And we've seen that recently, the fact that he's had to try to murder and then jail Alexander Navalny suggests that he's threatened by these sort of, any kind of domestic opposition. It's hard to guess where things are going, but, Vladimir Putin is going to do everything he can to keep in power because power for him allows his cronies to stay in power and continue to make money. And oftentimes when dictators lose power, it does not turn out well for them.
For a domestic audience, President Biden will likely try to make a big deal of his message to Putin, which is stop, make sure that you don't harbor these cyber criminals that are wreaking havoc on our computer systems across the U.S. with these ransomware attacks. What is the likelihood, in your view, that these criminal gangs are operating in Russia? Because the intelligence services in Russia, the Kremlin, they know they're there and they're okay with it. They are okay with those groups operating from Russia. Do you think that's the case, or do you think that's sort of overblown and there is really no connection between Russian intelligence services and these cyber criminals?
No, I'm very confident that that's the case. In a country like that, you do not take action that has a foreign policy implication without knowing where the Kremlin stands. We've seen, what the Kremlin does to people who sort of act on their own. They don't hesitate to jail them and even murder them in places around Europe and that type of thing. And so, it was Garry Kasparov who recently said, hey, there are no freelancers in a dictatorship. The consequences are too high. So these hackers, these ransom attacks, and these assassins, they're all aligned with the Kremlin in some sense. They must benefit the Kremlin. If these people are taking actions that are seen to be hurting Russian foreign policy, the Kremlin, believe me, the Kremlin and Putin will crack down on them. So at the very least, Putin is okay with them. They're not going to arrest them. But oftentimes they often use them for foreign policy purposes. And so, they see people, potential criminals and hackers. And as long as they, do some work on behalf of the state, they're allowed to sort of maybe, keep some of their ill-gotten gains as well.
It'll be really interesting to see this meeting unfold between President Biden and Vladimir Putin. John Cypher, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back to America Changed Forever from CBS News Radio. Paul Colby is the director of the Intelligence Project at the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School.
What do you think is the state of U.S. foreign policy at this moment as President Biden travels overseas for these meetings?
Look, I think you're starting to see foreign policy actually take place. What do I mean by that? I think you see a renewed emphasis on U.S. external relations, relationships with allies, and how we're going to engage with competitors and adversaries. And I think you're actually seeing a policy start to take place. I think years previous to Biden, you saw a series of ad hoc decisions, gut decisions, often reactive decisions that really didn't, from my mind, form a coherent policy or represent a coherent foreign policy, i.e. how the U.S. was going to engage in the world to advance U.S. interests. America First was confused with America Only, whereas I think a more nuanced view was that you can pursue an America First, an American interests foreign policy, best by engaging with friends and adversaries.
What do you think President Biden's primary focus should be as he meets the leaders of these G7 nations?
First and foremost, clearly, to show that America's back, that America values its allies, that America needs its allies, that America and the Western world, the democratic liberal world, benefit when they work together, when they work as one to counter malign foreign influences or influences which seek to undermine democracies, which seek to undermine liberal economies, which seek to divide allies from each other.
And how has some of those frayed relationships over the last 4, maybe 5 years, how has that impacted American foreign policy? Has it put the U.S. in a position of strength or a position of weakness?
Has it made the U.S. stronger or weaker to have our alliances fray, to have trust in the United States decline, to have faith in democracy as an institution which provides best benefits for its people? Has that made America stronger or weaker? It's made America weaker, for sure. You have had Russia and China rubbing their hands with glee, and I think sometimes, frankly, astonished at some of the actions that the U.S. had taken, which undermined its own self-interests and made their job easier. For example, President Putin and Russia, for over 20 years, have sought to undermine NATO. They see NATO as a major adversary, a major counterweight to Russian power and Russian freedom of action. And so they've sought to undermine NATO as an institution, to divide its members apart each other, and to undermine faith in its ability to respond effectively in times of crisis. As the U.S. tried to pull or thought about and made statements reflecting decreased faith in NATO, decreased emphasis in NATO, and injecting doubt into U.S. NATO commitments, that did Russia's job for them.
And how does that specifically strengthen Russia, Vladimir Putin's position across the world?
You know, you look at Putin's trajectory over the last 20 years, and he's pursued a very clear and very consistent strategy. So he's, when he came into power, Russia was a basket case. It's an economic basket case. It was a political basket case. It did not project power overseas, did not have respect or influence either among its close neighbors or far, and it was divided internally politically. And so Putin set about basically with three tasks. You know, one, to strengthen the center, i.e., to build a center of power within Moscow using the power ministries. So that's the defense ministry, the security services, the FSB and SVR, and the Ministry of Interior, to solidify power of the Kremlin, of those that ruled in Red Square. He then sought to expand the circle by establishing greater power of the oblasts, that is the states across the Russian Federation. And he did that by installing many former FSB, KGB military officials into positions into those states or oblasts, including as governors. So at one point, he fired all of these governors. It'd be as if, you know, a president of the United States had the power to fire all U.S. governors and installed his own people. So that helped reestablish power across Russia. And then the third thing that he worked to do was to establish power over the levers of the key sectors of the economy. So finance, arms production, transportation, oil and gas production. And what did he do there? The same thing, put in many of his own colleagues, former KGB, former military officials into positions of power and influence in those key industries so that the Russian state, that the Kremlin, had power and ability to influence them. And media, of course, is one of those as well. And then all of that was used to then solidify and project Russian power outside, starting with its neighbors, close neighbors. So that's why you see, have seen, for example, the intervention in Georgia and intervention in Ukraine. They saw any attempts of those states, states of the former Soviet Union, to join NATO, its avowed enemy, as being existentially important. And they demonstrated a willingness to go to war over that question. And then finally, it has been the long-term goal to undermine U.S. influence, to undermine what they saw as a unipolar U.S. world, a world where they saw the U.S. as being hegemonic, as having too much power. And they've sought to while increasing their own power to dilute U.S. power. One of those ways is to separate the U.S. from one of its power bases, that is, its alliances and allies.
I find it fascinating the what experts like you believe is the threat that Russia poses at this moment in history in Vladimir Putin. And so as we discuss this issue, I'm wondering, how does a President Biden push back against Vladimir Putin? How does he approach these meetings? You know, there over the years, the U.S. has imposed sanctions, but frankly, those don't seem to work in terms of changing behavior. Or do you think that that is the right approach? Just impose more sanctions?
No, I think sanctions are agree with you. They're overused. They can be effective when they're used, you know, more like a scalpel than with a hammer. And their overuse means you get diminishing returns. So if you apply sanction after sanction after sanction, countries and individuals learn how to adapt to that. So Russia, you know, while sanctions surely have hurt its economic growth, have hurt its prosperity, they've nonetheless, you know, not brought down Russia, not fundamentally undermined it as a country or regime, and from my mind, not materially affected the behaviors we've sought to affect. So we still see internal political repression. We still see use of assassination overseas. We still see rampant espionage, and we see cyber operations conducted against the United States and its allies. So all those continue in the face, and we still see, you know, occupation of Ukraine, Crimea, et cetera. And all that is taking place despite layer upon layer upon layer of U.S. sanctions. It's a tool for the U.S. to use, we're using the sanctions as a hammer to hit every nail in the problem set.
More to come on America Change Forever from CBS News Radio.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome back to America Change Forever from CBS News Radio. Let's continue with Paul Colby, the director of the Intelligence Project at the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School. Is there a silver bullet when it comes to changing the relationship between the U.S. and Russia?
No, there's no silver bullet. Look, I mean, I think that's part of the problem is we keep reaching for the easy button. We look for that one thing that will, you know, sort of fundamentally change the dynamic. So, and we've done it wrongly on both sides of the equation. So we've thought, well, if we just reset, we hit the reset button with Russia, we'll, you know, go back and work off mutual interests and everyone stop the behaviors that each the other finds objectionable. Well, that's successive administrations try that. Successive administrations failed because it doesn't address fundamental differences of interest, fundamental differences in worldview. And I think one thing that we fail to, and what that exhibits is that we fail to take into account what Russia's worldview is, what Russia's history is, how they view actions, how they view the world, how they view threats from their standpoint. Not to say that they're correct all the time in their worldview, or that their analysis and conclusions are correct or even acceptable. But at the same time, you have to understand it if you're going to affect it. Look, the Soviet Union, you know, lasted for over 70 years. We were in a Cold War for 50 years. That Cold War was marked by a quite sustained U.S. strategy of containing the Soviet Union, of opposing it where it posed the most acute threat to U.S. interests, to engage in shadow conflict, both in terms of intelligence operations and espionage, but also to engage in military conflict via proxies. When necessary, and to maintain a very clear policy of deterrence at a strategic level, i.e. nuclear deterrence, all the while understanding that you have to be able to talk to your adversary. That was done over successive administrations, Republican, Democratic, a policy that was sustained for 50 years, which in the end enabled the Soviet Union to collapse, not because of outside pressure, but because of its internal weakness and contradictions. And I think we need to take the same type of sustained policy and scope of what is it that we stand for? What is it that we want to do? What is it that we'll oppose and sustain that rather than taking kind of a quarterly assessment of tit for tat actions as our bottom line.
Well, and it's hard to do that really in this political environment that we're living in now, the partisan politics, different approaches to Russia and Vladimir Putin, in part because of the former administration's approach. I suspect that it's going to be hard to keep, you know, some sort of long-term policy in place in this environment.
I'm not sure that's true. I won't just talk about Trump administration, but Bush administration, Clinton administration, Obama administration all had their major failings with regards to Russia. But we saw this week that a bipartisan approach to a perceived external challenge can take place even in this political environment. And we're always in a political environment of one sort or another. Politics did start in the last few years, and you've had deep divisions between Democrats and Republicans over the decades on foreign policy issues.
My thanks to Paul Colby, who was referring to legislation that passed this week that would spend $250 billion over 5 years to bolster scientific research and development to ramp up competitiveness against China. Surprise, surprise, it was bipartisan. I'm Jeff Begays, and that is how America changed forever.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to America Changed Forever ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.